Good morning, Oregon, and thank you once again for loading me down and queuing me up. I'm Finn J.D. John, bringing you another daily episode of the Offbeat Oregon History Audio Edition podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column, every day except Thursday. On Thursdays, we do our Stories, Legends, and Lies of Oregon series, which brings you every Thursday a reading from what I like to call the literary canon of the Beaver State. Readings from people like Stuart Holbrook, Lishan Miller, Joaquin Miller, folks that made this place home long, long ago, and have described for us what it was like to be here. And yeah, some of them are raging liars. But then, isn't that what fiction writers do? Today I'm going to read you a story from Stuart Holbrook. It's kind of half historical fiction and half personal memoir. I'm not really quite sure which of the two it is. It was first published in the American Mercury magazine, H.L. Mencken's magazine, in 1943 in the heart of World War II. It's titled Lumberjack's Saturday Night. Oh, a night of hell-raising by logging camp crew was a far different thing in the mid-1940s than it had been just a few dozen years before. Just one dozen years before, actually. Let's get started, shall we? A wan December sun struggled briefly against the heavy clouds and then gave up, and the winter gloom of the Pacific Northwest settled down to bring night at 4 o'clock. All along the single street, the pavement began to gleam in the rain as one by one the neon signs came on and the scores of false front hotels, restaurants, stores, and beer joints. Sifting through the leaky sides of the joints came the music of jukeboxes, played by slugs furnished by the proprietors themselves, for Saturday night was coming to Chokertown, and it has long been an axiom here that the joint with the most light and the most noise gets the business. Business in Chokertown means loggers, lumberjacks. Less than half a mile from the High Lead Hotel in the center of town begins the vast forest that runs almost uninterrupted for 100 miles west to the Pacific shore and 50 miles east to the top of the Cascade Range. It is a tremendous forest, and here in the Rain Belt it is growing fast enough, so many foresters say, to keep Chokertown's loggers busy until the Round River freezes solid and alcohol and snuff drift copiously out of hemlock bark. There, in an opening of this forest, stands Chokertown. Already 50 years a lumber town, but now getting a new lease on life as a place of entertainment also. A blow-in town. A whoopee place for lumberjacks. Tire and gas rationing brought Chokertown its new nightlife. It was really a revival, for a quarter century ago, Chokertown made lumber and also served as a place for loggers to blow her in. Then came the automobile and the good roads. Roads led right up to camp doors in the tall timber. No longer had a lumberjack to toil for 6 months without going to town to get his teeth fixed, as it is euphemistically termed. He could go to town every night in the week if he wanted to, and he did. He spent a little, but not much, money, and returned to camp the same night. But this new style lumberjack seldom went to Chokertown at all. He lit out for Seattle, for Aberdeen, for Bellingham, the big towns. So small Chokertown kept sawing logs into lumber and lived a rather staid life. The great whoopee days had gone, never to return, or so most people thought, even though Chokertown's mills produced millions of feet of lumber every year. Then, in 1940, began a demand for lumber the like of which had never been seen. Lumber for cantonments, for hangars, for ships, lumber without end. Pearl Harbor set loose a new and greater demand, which continued unabated through the war years and after. Prices hit the ceiling, and so, finally, did wages in the woods. Along came the tire menace. At first, the loggers, like other folks, gave it little thought. But as old tires gave out, the logger found he would have to stay in camp nights, or walk, usually a matter of from 20 to 40 miles. So the jack stayed in camp, listening fitfully to the radio, or boredly to the old-timers who liked to do some stove logging. The younger jacks soon tired of such doings, for they were not accustomed to 6 months solid of camp life, or even 6 weeks of camp life without a break. They pooled the surviving travel equipment, couple tires here, couple more there, and a car, and ganged up for a trip to town on Saturday night. In many cases, it was not too difficult to persuade the bull of the woods, the logging boss, to run a train to town right after Saturday's whistle. It became a habit.
Look out, Chokertown! Here we come!
So last Saturday night, just as has been done on many Saturdays recently, the two-spot coupled up a mulligan car and a caboose at Camp 6 of the Dos Wallops Logging Company.
The Loki's whistle let go a blast, and inside of 2 minutes, 140 loggers piled aboard. The two spots bell rang, and she started with the train for Chokertown, 20 miles away.
"We're the blue-eyed, bandy-legged, hump-backed old Mackinaw hodags from Dose Wallops!"
Down the mountain, across high trestles, over dizzy canyons, rolled the two carloads of lumberjacks, while the two-spot moaned and chugged, letting go a blast on the curves. Inside the swaying, bounding cars, young loggers shouted pleasant obscenities to each other. The Loki rattled on.
"Look out, Chokertown, here we come! 80 feet to the nearest limb and 6 foot through the butt!"
The two-spot's bell began to ring, the whistle sounded, the train crossed a switch with a clatter and ground to a stop at the log dump beside the river and less than 20 yards from the main street. Under blinking lights, the boys from the woods could see some of their handiwork. The log pond of the big sawmill filled with sticks, big ones, the stuff they'd felled and bucked and sent to the saws. Under the lights, the pond men were still working, feeding the huge logs to the bull chain that took them up the curved slip and onto the winding band saws. Mills can work all night. Loggers can't. In half an hour, Chokertown was alive. I went to the high lead first and found the bar line too deep, all drinking beer, the only drink served. The overflow stamped into Joe's Tavern and the Logger's Rest, two other beer places. A few of the more serious drinkers did not stop at all until they got to the state liquor store where the state of Washington purveys hard stuff at rather high prices.
"No liquor to be consumed on the premises," says a sign. "Who the hell wants to?"
It was Dan Peters, a tall and rugged hook tender from Dose Wallops. With 2 pints of rye in his tin coat and 2 Chokerman pals similarly rigged, the three headed for the Stockholm. The Stockholm is not the fanciest place in town, but it has that something about it which attracts young and older loggers who take their fun as seriously as their work. Its modest neon sign, looking so modern and new against the false front of weather-beaten board, says simply that this is, quote, "the Stockholm, good food, beer, rooms." Inside, too, the Stockholm is a mixture of periods. It is one great room with a bar down one side, booths on another, food counter at the rear. In the exact center is a gigantic barrel stove, its pipe running nearly 10 feet to the high ceiling and then ranging 30 feet through haywire loops to the rear wall. The floor between the stove and lunch counter is broken only by one of the biggest and gaudiest jukeboxes to ever come out of Chicago. It is lighted like Borealis and it fairly gleams and leers. Above the bar and hiking back to 5 cent beer days is the conventional moth-eaten deer's head. Back of the bar stands Gus himself, the only bartender left in Chokertown with an indubitable walrus mustache. The bar gleams from polish. The glasses are piled in intricate patterns. A small framed sign contains a $1 bill and a historic notation. "First dollar taken over this bar, August 22nd, 1899.
"Hello, fallers,"
Gus greeted the arrivals. The booths already were filled with loggers. Loggers and girls, guzzling beer or beer spiked with rye. The juke was hitting "Somebody else is taking my place" loud enough to be heard above the alcoholic laughter. Half a dozen couples were on the floor. Not a Mackinaw on the men, but all in conventional city clothes. Dan the hook tender and his pal sat down at a booth where 4 half-consumed glasses of beer still sat on the table. Just then the juke ceased for a moment and 2 couples came to the booth. And right here marked, better than anything else could, the change that has come over lumberjacks. The 2 couples were strangers to Dan and his pals. They obviously had been occupying the booth, but no roughhouse ensued.
"Guess we took your booth," Dan said, starting to rise.
"Sorry."
"That's all right," one of the strangers spoke up. "We can all squeeze in."
They did, too. The boys from Camp 6 spiked everybody's beer. Turned out the other 2 lads were Gippo spruce loggers from the opposite side of the river. In a little while, everything was rosy. Dan danced with one of the girls and later took her upstairs to look at the stars. One of the Gippo loggers passed out and slid under the table very quietly. Booze and bods, maybe, but not battle. The Lumberjack's Trinity had lost its 3rd angle. Over at the high lead, loggers still lined the bars and filled the booths, they and their girls. The jukebox blared endlessly. I watched while men slid under tables, girls screamed beery laughter or wept into their glasses, and one old battle axe with a deep bourbon contralto stood up by the juke and sang "Goodbye, Little Darlin'" in a true and musical, if husky, voice, while a rigging slinger from Hamma Hamma, way to hell and gone over the other side of the hump, wept great tears and told me his girl didn't love him anymore. The odd thing is that nobody hit anybody. Nobody threw a beer bottle.
and those who might have looked closely at the husky contralto's hands would have seen calluses on them. For 8 hours that day, she had been pulling lumber, boards to you, off the chain in the mill across the river. She was but one of the hundreds of women who were still working in a mill. And now a likely-looking lad rushed over to the big contralto and filled her glass with whiskey. She broke into her own song without the benefit of the juke music.
"I'm a tearing old stiff full of slivers of Sitka, and I'm packing the wallop that went to beat Hitler."
"Amen, sister! Hold our cutie and watch that rigging!"
The juke blared again, and the dancers cavorted. The high lead was shaking and shivering in every one of its old boards and timbers. The proprietor told me it was going to be $1,000 evening, with no breakage except possibly for a few beer glasses.
"No, sir," he told me, "loggers don't live in trees anymore, and they won't necessarily eat hay if you sprinkle whiskey on it."
In the Red Front department store across the street, a young rigging man from Camp 6 was ordering a copy of Trees and Forests of the Western United States by Hanslick, a standard work on forests. In another section of the same store,
"We sell everything,"
a high climber from Hemlock Bay was buying a whole list of stuff for his wife back in camp, threads and dyedies and a cord for the electric flat iron and such domestic things. Mac's barber shop, 4 chairs, had a waiting line and many of the boys were getting the works, shampoo and all, while a Filipino lad shined their shoes just as though they were city slickers. The talk in the shop, I noted, was not about women and automobiles, but about log production. Across from the barber shop, I could see the windows and signs of Painless Prentice, the chain dentists. 4 patients were in the chairs. This was the ultimate, the incredible. Loggers coming to town to get their teeth fixed and actually going to a dentist? It almost passed belief. 1 block away down on the riverbank, a row of 3 shacks represented all that was left of Chokertown's one-time full 2 blocks of cribs. In 1920, the cribs here numbered at least a score, and they housed, so old-timers say, 60 women. Tonight, 6 women would entertain perhaps as many as 20 loggers, possibly 30. This doesn't mean that morals have changed. They never change. It means that many of today's loggers have wives, either in camp or in town. I went back to my room at the High Lead, and there, over a few drinks, talked with a forester who had once been a lumberjack. Now he had charge of a 40-acre tree nursery owned and operated by a group of logging concerns. "So loggers themselves are planting trees in these incredible times?" I asked.
"We'll plant about 8 million this winter," he said matter-of-factly. "Beginning next season, about 10 million a year. We raise them from seed at the nursery in Nisqually."
"Do I understand correctly?" I said. "Did you say this nursery is owned and run by the logging operators themselves, the lumbermen?"
"That's right, and we can raise enough trees at Nisqually to plant every burned-over acre in Oregon and Washington. What's more, we are planting them."
I reflected on the late and terrific Jigger Jones, the old woods boss who swore he wouldn't leave a tree standing between Bangor and Seattle, nor a virgin anywhere. The times were changing even more than I had thought. At 5 minutes to midnight, the 2-spot blew a whistle, and I went over to the siding to see how the boys had been making out. Perhaps a score of them showed signs of alcohol in mild doses. 2 were indisputably drunk, but moving under their own power. 1 was drunk and had a black eye. Only 8 were missing, and 5 of those were married men with wives in town. In my day in the woods, I recalled, the only ones who would have been ready to return to camp at midnight would have been those who were carried. I watched the boys climb aboard. The bell rang, and away went the hell roarers of Camp 6 back to the timber. One by one, the lights went out along Chokertown's main drag until only the high lead showed in the dark. I went in and talked with old Bill, the night clerk and chef, about lumberjacks, old and new.
"No," he said, "they don't kick out windows anymore. But 1'll kick hell out of more timber than 2 of his grandpappies could. They're highball these days. Don't spend so much money in town, nowhere near. Never throw money away like it used to be. These boys going to get their money's worth. Hardly ever get to fighting. Just like to drink some beer, to dance them jitter things, play pinball machines."
I asked Bill if the young loggers were different in any other ways from the old timers. He eyed me a moment, then spoke slowly and, I thought, sadly.
"Well," he said, "they wear rayon underwear."
"That's all?" Bill turned his bloodhound sad eyes on me.
"No,"
he said, then lowered his voice as one does in speaking of some terrible infirmity.
"They smoke cigarettes and use talcum powder after they shave."
I went to bed. Chokertown had gone to bed too, that is, all except for the sawmill. I could hear the faint whine of its saws all through the rainy night, and down on the pond I could see men poling logs to the ever-hungry slip. 4 miles up the mountain, the two-spot sounded a last moan on her whistle as she headed up a ravine, carrying the boys who were better loggers and far shrewder playboys than their fathers were. Well, that's it for today. This was reprinted from H.L. Mencken's The American Mercury Magazine, March 1943. It's by Stuart Holbrook, the legendary Oregon writer. He is, of course, writing about a lumber camp in Washington, but it could very easily have been in Oregon, possibly in Douglas County, maybe. In fact, it's sounding an awful lot like Cottage Grove, Oregon to me back in the day. If you're listening to this for the first time and would like some more information about Offbeat Oregon history, you can get everything at our central website at offbeatoregon.com. This is the complete catalog of about 200 columns going back to 2008, plus links out to audio and text feeds on RSS and iTunes and to the Facebook page and Twitter feed. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, written by Carmen Ficarra. Coming to Corvallis? Drop me a line. Let's grab a cup of coffee and talk history. Drop me a line anyway, in fact. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com, or if you do Twitter, just plain @offbeatoregon. This podcast recording is covered under a Creative Commons license. Details of that are at offbeatoregon.com/cc. However, the magazine article that I am reading is in the public domain. That's it for today. Tomorrow I'll be telling you the story of Auburn, Oregon, which is a long-gone gold town, which is now a ghost town. But Auburn is where the Eastern Oregon Gold Rush got its start. For a time, it was a teeming, rough-hewn metrop of 6,000 souls. Ground zero in the Gold Rush, massive mining camp is basically what this place was. It was founded in 1861, and it was gone 4 years later. I'll tell you that story after about 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. In the meantime, go and fill up the rest of today with good stuff. Bye now.